Welcome to another edition of Expanding Mind. I'm your host, Eric Davis, continuing the conversations about the cultures of consciousness. I don't watch TED videos very often. I find them cloying and vaguely disturbing, even when they're decent or even good some of the time. They seem to sort of break a certain complexity of thinking and sort of wrapping up ideas in these kind of candy packages of feel-good emotions and a certain narrative arc and a certain kind of up-with-people vibe that I find increasingly I have increasing skepticism about. That said, I do watch them when friends send links, and I was directed towards a TEDx talk. TEDx is, of course, a different story because there's more weirdness and fringe involved, although some of the problems still remain. But I was sent a link to a TEDx talk by Mikey Siegel, who is our guest today, on the topic of consciousness hacking. And there's something about that phrase that really got me. I was like, yeah, okay, I want to see what this is about. And that's for another reason, for things that are on my mind right now, is thinking about hacking and thinking about the culture of hacking and thinking about the sort of culture of enthusiasm, curiosity, discovery, weirdness, altered states, this whole sort of nexus of ideas that surrounded technology when I first got into this stuff in the 1990s, and sort of wondering where that spirit went, how it's been co-opted, how it's transformed, where is it re-emerging. So I was very intrigued by this notion of consciousness hacking, and so clicked on over to TEDx Santa Cruz, I believe, and watched the talk and was very impressed, really enjoyed it, partly because Mikey's coming at it from a very engineering point of view. He was a roboticist, you know, serious engineering chops, MIT, you know, some commercial work, etc. And then, as you'll hear, found his own way towards a real fascination and personal concern with higher states of mind, with the evolution of consciousness, the transformation of consciousness, and the question of how technology, and particularly the emerging world of neurohacking, hackable EEG devices, the return of biofeedback into the sort of DIY culture, but now with so much more technological opportunities and communities. So it's a very, very interesting story, and I think it raises some really good questions and also some really exciting possibilities for a different way of exploring consciousness in our most curious era. So, but before we bring Mikey onto the show, of course, our co-host here on Expanding Mind, Maja Dawu. Hey, Maja.
Hi, Eric.
So if somebody had like this machine and said, "Hey, if we make a little incision in the back of your skull and we plug this in, you can achieve, you know, a jiva mukti or, you know, some high state of non-dual awareness." Would you try it out?
I know. We always come back to this question. It comes up a lot, right? I think also as technology progresses, the question's getting more and more big for people to answer, and probably we'll get faced with it sooner or later. I mean, people make decisions to put machines in their body all the time, like whether it's a pacemaker or a screw in your hip or whatever. And I think that there's a connotation with placing things in the brain that, of course, people have a lot of problems with. You know, all you got to do is watch One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest to know that can go really wrong. Like, if you get technology in some parts of your body, it can go wrong, too. But I think the sketchy part is that there's human error in everything. So, yeah, it's fine to think, like, yeah, we have this thing, and it'll do this thing, and everything will be great. But for every one of those things that we already have, there's all kinds of errors that occur. So if I were to get one of those, I would sure wait until way later after they had already done it a lot and had other people experience the mess ups. Which
yeah,
I don't know that you can ever get rid of the mess ups. I think that's inherent in the human error situation. So
right, but you might increase the odds by being embracing your late adopter status.
Right.
Like, well, hold on for a little while, and then I'll roll the dice. But I think the odds will be a little better. That makes a lot of sense. That's very.
Right.
I certainly
wouldn't be the first one, I'll tell you that right now.
Great. Well, with that, let's see whether Mikey would be the first one. Hey, Mikey, welcome to Expanding Mind.
Hey, thanks, Eric. And hi, Maja. Good to meet you.
Hi.
So, yeah, we'll get to this question, what you'd put inside, you know, how you'd plug your own brain up to a machine. But I want to start with your background, your story, because I think it's a really interesting one. I mean, just what kind of training you had, the way you thought about the world, and then the kind of changes that happened, the insights and questions that started to arise that really set you in a different direction, but one that, you know, keeps the technological engineering thread very much alive, but really points it in a different direction. I think it's a great... I think it's a great tale, so I'd invite you to tell us.
Cool, yeah, happily. Thanks, Eric. And then we'll for sure hopefully get to what you guys are just talking about, because obviously that's a great interest of mine also. So starting from the beginning. So, you know, my background is I guess, relatively speaking, you know, for traditional engineering. I did my undergraduate work in computer engineering and then ended up sort of getting into robotics a little, spending some time at NASA doing robotics, and then ended up at MIT doing robotics. And it was a little bit of an outside of the box kind of thing as far as engineering is concerned. We were really kind of on that sci-fi fringe of robotics, doing social robots, robots that express emotion and interact with people. And, at that time I really got to think deeply about this intersection between humans and technology. So not only was I doing all the sort of traditional kind of hardcore, you know, groundwork on the engineering side, but, you know, two of the people on my thesis committee were social psychologists. And there was really deep thinking here about how technology can affect people. And at that time I was thinking about it more in terms of psychology and belief systems and persuasion, but it would actually end up taking me in a very different direction
Cynthia Martel?
Cynthia Brazil.
Brazil, that's right.
Yeah, who is getting a lot of press right now because she actually just announced her startup. I think it's called Jibo, J-I-B-O. I hope that's right. It's one of the first efforts at actually putting a social robot in the home, which is something that I've been thinking about and working on, you know, my original work for a long time.
I just bring that up because I visited her at the lab many years ago, and I think it's one thing that's important to pull out is that here's this idea. The idea there is, again, how do we use ideas about what's going on in human psychology to create robotic interfaces that are able to engage with human beings better, that's going to elicit their emotions, that's going to help give them cues. But it's very interesting work, but it also implies a very particular way of thinking about what human beings are and how they interface with technology.
Exactly. And I would say one of the major takeaways from that whole period for me was this sort of what you're getting at, this understanding that from an engineer's perspective, we think about the functionality of the stuff we're building based on kind of these quantifiable aspects of, you know, if it's a robot, like how, you know, it's computer vision system, how well can it identify objects, it's, you know, its end effector, its arm, how accurately can it pick stuff up, how well can it navigate in a room. These are the things we think of as it being functional, but if you put a robot into a hospital and it can perform all these tasks perfectly, but people are frightened by it or don't trust it, then it's no longer functional. Not in a sort of floofy kind of, you know, abstract sense, but in a very, very real sense, it no longer works. Because if a human is in the loop, you at a very deep level have to think about how people relate to that technology.
Well, and you think about, like, if you go to a hospital, the difficulty most people have with the interface with doctors and nurses, like, is enough problem on its own. But to try to get it, like, with a robot to have that happen, I mean, certainly you can see how difficulties might arise.
Yeah, well, you have both sides, which is interesting, because you have also a robot which in many ways can be adaptable in ways that humans can't. It can change its gender or its accent or, you know, the style of languaging, you know, all kinds of things. But, you know, I don't want to get, that could be
I
a whole
I pulled just, you off your track. So you got this experience working with social robots, and it led you further.
And, yeah, and so I won't go too far into the details here, but really my life was progressing really well, actually. I got sort of the good job and was living the good life, and everything on paper seemed great. And I was met with kind of the unfortunate circumstance that some, you know, really, I guess, privileged people have a chance of meeting, which is where you've sort of checked most of the things off your list that you thought were supposed to make you happy, that you thought were sort of the things that once you finally achieved those, you'd realize some sense of contentment or well-being. And I was in a very real way struck with the incongruency there, that that even though I had all of these things that I'd been thinking were kind of going to be they were the missing pieces, so to speak, that wasn't the reality of it. The reality was there was still a deeper sense of discontent, of incompleteness, of unhappiness. And I wouldn't, you know, it wasn't like I was suffering from serious depression or something like that. It just was this feeling that somehow there was something deeper beyond the external circumstances. And so I kind of, with an engineering mind and a scientist mind, I went off trying to figure out this deeper question of, I guess, human well-being, you could say, or how it is that people, what is the deepest, most fundamental way that people can realize a sort of a completeness, a maximization of human potential in terms of our own experience. And that led me to kind of diving pretty deeply into a lot of different Eastern traditions and exploring the various meditation techniques and retreats and, you know, even psychedelics quite a bit, just sort of across the board, looking at what's out there. And what I came to realize is that these tools and techniques that exist, and a lot of them, if you actually really stick to them, can be very effective, that those are technologies. And they're not things that grow on trees that you sort of pick off and sort of exist in some natural way. These are human inventions, and they're inventions that were created by really scientists of the mind, people that had in great depth with great precision explored the inner space, how our own perception works, how our own mental process works, how our own sort of subjective experience of reality works. And from that understanding, they were able to essentially build these largely conceptual tools to help guide and shift people's experience. And the other thing that I discovered, which is really critical in all of this, is that there is a real potential that exists that is not an abstract sort of spiritual concept, but a very real grounded concept that has been around for, not a concept, but experience that has been around for thousands of years, and studied and understood and is beginning to work its way very slowly into academia, which is the concept of enlightenment or non-dual experience or unitive experience, and not as a fleeting phenomenon, but as a real persistent shift that is possible for people. And I was able to, you know, talk to many people that have this experience, and ultimately able to link up with some researchers, particularly a guy named Jeffrey Martin that is a longtime collaborator of mine that has put significant time into the sort of into the scientific understanding of this. And so what I came away with was the ability to kind of take a step back and look at all of this outside of a religious or spiritual context and to say, okay, as an engineer, what's happening here? There seems to be this this very real and in many ways completely measurable shift that people experience that seems to be at a very deep level the resolution or eradication of human suffering. And by suffering, I don't mean like physical pain or difficult life circumstances or disease. I mean essentially at a deep level how we respond to these adverse situations. So if you spill the milk, right, the milk is going to spill, but do you cry over it or do you not cry over it? And there seems to be a dramatic change that's possible that also corresponds to some other aspects of subjective experience. And
I want to ask you a little bit more about you when you were searching, you know, the sort of searching. I know you're still searching and looking at these things, but there was sort of a period where you were really going to retreats and doing meditation and da-da-da. You know, as you did so, you were, of course, encountering, you know, these practices which you have rightly identified as technologies that have developed over, you know, centuries or even millennia in some cases. But they're embedded in all of these different kind of scenes. Some of them are, you know, maybe they were Hindu religious things or Asian Buddhism or New Age self-help stuff or ayahuasca groups or whatever the mix, where you find that the sort of techniques are also embedded in various spiritual, religious, woo kinds of context. And I'm curious, as you went through and were sort of, in some sense, separating out what you thought were interesting engineering problems with the engineering of the mind and consciousness included. What was your take on the spiritual and religious elements? Did it seem like it was no longer appropriate, or that you could see the way in which it led to bad situations, or, you know, what was your reaction to the kind of the religious side or the spiritual side in the broader sense of these practices as you were encountering them?
It took a long time for me to, and it's an ongoing process, it's a never-ending process, but to sort of dig myself out of one particular belief system or another, particularly a spiritual kind of belief system. And a lot of these belief systems, I don't know if I'd call it intentional, but they sort of evolve in a way that they become silos. And part of that is actually in some ways helpful for the actual ultimate intention of trying to drive people towards a particular experience, because it helps to not constantly be sort of wandering and searching and exploring. So a lot of them sort of reinforce the validity of their own, you know, of their own perspective. But it took a while to sort of dig myself out of that and realize that these are just a collection of different tools that are accessible, and some are more compatible with certain people and some are less compatible with certain people, and there's a sort of a matching kind of problem there. But no one has a particular, like, claim to a greater or deeper truth. The only benchmark that I use, really, for all of this is to what extent are they effective? And I'm really interested in getting at the very root of human suffering. And so to what extent are these traditions actually, in a very real way, shifting people's experience? And in that sense, you find that some of the most popular traditions are really more telling people what they want to hear and satisfying people at a conceptual level, but not actually providing a deeper resolution to the root of where their suffering comes from.
Well, and let me ask you this, because I feel like one of the best quantitative ways to measure that is you always see, well, are they walking their talk, right? So many people talk this talk, but very few actually walk this walk. And I wonder if you've looked into it all, any studies of cultures who have done this as a way of being. Because one thing I would argue with you about is that these states are not natural, because there are individuals who are born with these kinds of states of being throughout history in stories and myths, and then sometimes reported in China and India and all over the place. There'll be these freaky people that just seem to be happy and have these kind of states of being. And then on higher levels, there's like little pockets of, you know, groups or people that actually do take this on as a lifestyle, whether they learn it through the technologies, through the tools, like you mentioned, or if there are some inherent, like, little pockets of tribes in the Amazon or whatever that just exist in that beingness from the get-go. So do you feel like if you could find some group that had somehow accomplished that living without suffering, would that be the way to measure that? Or how could you, like, as a scientist, right, like, discover the efficacy of those things, I guess, is the most important question.
Yeah, cool. So first, I hope I didn't misstate anything. I definitely wouldn't say that experience is and just as a reference point, Jeffrey Martin's term for it is persistent non-symbolic experience, just to have a sort of a non-religious term. And so I definitely wouldn't call that an unnatural state. More what I was referring to was the tools or techniques that various traditions have created to sort of guide people there. Those are just human inventions is more
right.
what I'm getting at. Actually, I think the state itself is arguably inevitable and a natural process of our human evolution, potentially. I don't really know.
Who knows? Maybe maybe this was a common state in the Paleolithic, and that all we're really
right.
trying to do is get ourselves back to a kind of, you know, sort of baseline state of acceptance with whatever is arising that was, you know, pervasive in the, you know, 100,000 years ago. And it was really the rising of agriculture and the state and these dense symbolic systems that kind of got us knocked off. I mean, it might be the most natural thing in the world.
Yeah.
Totally possible. I don't know, and I think there's a lot of romanticizing that goes on in terms of, you know, the sort of, you know, what happened way back when. But frankly, I feel very fortunate because coming at this as an engineer, I can very comfortably to a lot of these things say I don't know, and it's okay, because really what I'm concerned with actually was sort of what you're getting at, Maja, which is okay, how can you kind of measure this? And
right.
that is one fundamental and necessary ingredient to the engineering approach to this, because if you can't measure it, if you can't quantify it, then you haven't actually brought it into the lens of science. And the sort of model I'm working on is that there's this relationship between science and engineering, where science, in a sense, is building the map. It's building
right.
the conceptualization of this shared reality. And then once we have that conceptualization, or once it's been quantified, then engineering can come in and actually build the tools to navigate that map or navigate that terrain. And so the work in terms of actually quantifying this is well underway. There are good enough models right now in terms of, for example, how this manifests in the brain to already begin building technologies that can directly facilitate the experience. And that actually is already happening as well. So this isn't a sci-fi concept. This is actually already existing science with already built technologies that are beginning to explore it. So what we're talking about is much closer than even a lot of the transhumanist ideas that are talked about. This is something that's, I think, really achievable in the next 5 to 10 years.
Well, let's talk about some of those tools and some of those models. What to you seems the most ripe sort of technologies and goals to look at in terms of what parts of the brain we're reading, what aspects of
physiology are we tracking in order to help in culture or through biofeedback or other approaches to generate or trigger these states?
Yeah, that's a great and central question. So there's a few ways to kind of go about that. There's a few categories of, maybe I could say three categories of approaches that, you know, roughly speaking, that I think are interesting and already have progress in all three. There's feedback-based approaches, and a lot of people are probably familiar with the concept of like neurofeedback or biofeedback. It's been around since the mid or late 60s. And as you mentioned, Eric, there's actually a renaissance happening now in more sophisticated forms of real-time fMRI and MEG and spatial imaging feedback. And then there's stimulation-based approaches where you're actually directly stimulating most likely the brain or possibly the body, and that could be through magnetic stimulation, electrical stimulation, ultrasound stimulation, sound, light. There's lots of possibilities there. And then there's actually like hybrid approaches where you say, okay, a lot of these traditional methods, when I say traditional, they could be modern, like invented in the last few years, or they could be thousands of years old, but traditional in the sense that they really rely mainly on spoken and written word. A lot of these traditional approaches actually are really effective. As you can imagine, potentially taking almost a quantified approach to the traditional paths, where you actually can optimize for a given individual what sort of, you could think of as what technique or what tool or what teaching is most effective for them at a particular time, and you can sort of gauge their progress as they move along and switch and redirect them. So there are optimized approaches for that. And all three of those are in progress, and all three of those approaches are showing really promising results. And before we kind of dive into those, to add another sort of big picture perspective, in terms of what I'm actually doing and the way that I'm spending most of my time, it's, you know, I have my own, when I look at this problem of really trying to use, essentially at its heart, trying to use technology to eradicate human suffering from the inside out, that's really kind of the vision for all of this. I see, for me personally, two approaches. One is the question of what can I build myself, and that's, you know, I have a startup and some projects that I'm working on and a Burning Man project, and, you know, this approach, technology that I'm trying to create with in collaboration with some other people. And then another question, which is sort of a meta approach, what can I do to actually facilitate other people building technologies as well, and that's probably how I'm spending most of my time these days. And so there's a community that I'm organizing called Consciousness Hacking. There's a larger community that's coming together that we're calling Transformative Technology, sort of to name the space, and there's a conference that we're beginning to plan and, you know, hackathons and some other events around that. So just to give some perspective, that's kind of my relationship to all of this. And so,
Before we go into some of the specific technologies or things that you're working on and some of these nitty-gritty questions, we're going to have to take a break. You're listening to Expanding Mind with Eric Davis and Maja Dau, talking with Mikey Spiegel about consciousness hacking, and we'll be right back.
Welcome back to Expanding Mind on the Progressive Radio Network. This is Maja Dau. We're here with Eric Davis talking to Mikey Spiegel, and we're talking about hacking into your brain. Everybody's favorite. So there are these astounding technologies happening, as you pointed out before the break. They're already going on. I don't know if people read, but they had just found the shut-off switch to consciousness. They were doing some brain surgery. I think it was on some woman that was having maybe like epilepsy or something, and they were kind of poking around in there, and they found a part of her brain where they stimulated it, and her consciousness shut down. So they're making like these discoveries. And then the government, of course, we mentioned before on a different show, is actually researching chips to put into veterans' brains to treat PTSD in order to kind of get rid of their suffering spots in the brain. So these are active and occurring now. And I was wondering, one of the things I wanted to ask you, in your experience with the technologies that you've been working with or are familiar with, if there have been adverse reactions to any of them, or do any of like the biofeedback stuff that you work with, is there anyone that just like freaks out or has a negative experience on it, or do you find generally everyone kind of has a super beneficial experience?
Okay, so good question. So these technologies, like any technology, are these are double-edged swords. And first of all, anything that we're talking about can be used for lots of different purposes. They can be used explicitly, you know, whether it's brain stimulation or feedback approaches or whatever, can be used explicitly to harm people. So it's not like these tools are in any way immune to having detrimental effects to people. It's more a question of what your intention is, what you're designing the thing to do, and then your skill in designing that interaction.
Right.
And so I'm sure that in the history of neuro and biofeedback and various forms of brain stimulation, there are probably lots of stories of people having adverse reactions. But generally speaking, actually, these are fairly safe interventions. You don't really actually hear, even in, for example, you hear a lot about TDCS, which is transcranial direct current stimulation. It's something that's getting a lot of press lately, and is actually something that's really popular in the DIY world. So there's a whole community of people that are building these technologies themselves, and I've done the same thing and done my own sort of private research with these devices, and it's essentially literally running a very small electrical current through the brain, and of course the immediately the response to that is like, oh, that sounds dangerous. you're running electricity
like
through the brain.
Shock therapy, right? But it's interesting because if you think about, like, for how many years they used electroshock therapy to treat suffering, I mean, it's kind of weird that you run the low current through and it essentially, like as you're claiming, treats suffering a little bit like electroshock therapy, but on a smaller scale, right?
Yeah, it's on a much smaller scale, 2 to 3 orders of magnitude smaller, and it's actually considered very safe enough that in this whole sort of DIY world of people basically strapping 9-volt batteries to their head, there's and then just as a disclaimer, that's not actually what you do. It's a little more work involved. So don't go strapping batteries to your head. But there's very few reports of any issues coming up. And I also just want to clarify one thing. There is, from my perspective, almost no work into dealing, so this gets tricky, with language. There's almost no work in dealing with what I'm talking about in terms of suffering. There is lots of work in terms of dealing with specific clinical conditions, which of course, if you can help someone with their, with severe form of depression, or if you can help someone with, improved memory, or you can help someone with tinnitus or something like that, these things are, incredibly important and helpful and all of that. But in terms of this concept of persistent non-symbolic experience and sort of getting at the very root of human suffering, as it's commonly talked about from Eastern traditions, essentially engineering enlightenment, there's almost no work in that space. Even the work in, you know, for decades and decades in sort of the world of bio and neurofeedback that was sort of pointing in that direction was never really
if anyone studied the early biofeedback techniques, it was done by Dr. Elmer Green, who was working specifically with yogis and with meditators. Like, that was back in the 60s. And then it just kind of, like, you're right, nobody took it any further or, like, cared about it or investigated that. And that was actually the inception of that kind of technology with Elmer Green. He was really going into looking at the swamis, looking at these people, and trying to get some kind of hook in with the enlightenment thing, but then it just kind of, like, disappeared.
Totally. It disappeared along with, you know, frankly, right around the same time that the psychedelics research disappeared. So, and there's, you know, lots of political stories and all kinds of stuff around that, but those all sort of went away at the same time. And interestingly, they're both experiencing a renaissance at the same time. And that's not to say specifically in terms of researching enlightenment, but those approaches, both neurofeedback and biofeedback and psychedelics research, are having a little bit of a renaissance in the last 10 years or so.
Yeah, I think this is something really to underscore, is that it's kind of a paradox in that as we have become more and more scientific in thinking about ourselves, at least in the West, and really all over the world overall, and there's more and more focus on the brain and neuroscience as the key to many, many questions that we're still asking ourselves about consciousness, about, you know, how do we do free will, all these sort of things. So there's a tremendous focus on the brain, which on the one hand is sort of in the opposite direction of enlightenment, of anything valuable in religion, anything, you know, all these higher states, that's all like old stuff. But paradoxically, if you want to have a complete account, a complete neuroscientific account of human experience, you have to go into these twilight realms, these shadow realms, these spaces, whether they're lucid dreaming or they're psychedelics or there are the capacity, which we haven't mentioned, the specific capacity that people can develop using biofeedback to gain control over autonomic functions that they're not even, you're not even aware of how you're doing it, and yet you're able to do it. So these capacities, suddenly, even for the very secular people, you have to take account for these things. And what it's doing as it goes forward is to create these spaces now for people to experiment themselves. And I really wanted to make another point or ask you a question about one of the things it seems that you're doing that I really appreciate in talking about consciousness hacking and in emphasizing the DIY collaborative maker approach to these issues is that you're providing an alternate narrative to the dominant technology consciousness narrative of our world, at least out here on the West Coast, which is transhumanism, which has a much different take on how and why we bring technology into the body, bring technology into the mind. It has a specific set of goals of efficiency, of power, of control, of hedonistic engineering. And the kind of principles and goals that you're suggesting with consciousness hacking, you have your own particular take on enlightenment and the relief of suffering, but even beyond that, it's a very different kind of vibe. And I really want to invite you to sort of make that contrast and explain what you feel is different about the sort of space that's emerging around consciousness hacking and transformative technologies as providing an alternative to these sort of more, you know, pedal to the metal transhumanist models that we hear so much about.
Yeah, great question, Eric. So generally speaking, I think the prevailing mindset, you know, understandably, it's just sort of the where the cultural momentum is around creating tools or even if we specifically talk about how we would want our experience to be augmented, It has to do a lot with the satisfaction of our desires, you know, being able to achieve more, to accomplish more, to remember more so we can be more effective, to be able to feel exactly the way we want, when we want, to have our circumstances around us appear in a certain way. It's really, from, you know, my perspective on the sort of the transhumanist movement, is it's really about giving humans the ability to, in a very deep way, have the complete and instantaneous satisfaction of desire. And I don't mean that as a criticism. That's, you know, that's potentially a very powerful avenue. But if you think about it, in, for example, in Eastern traditions, it's actually the exact opposite approach, the polar opposite, where the approach there is actually to find a sense of equanimity with what is, a sense of well-being and contentment, completely independent of circumstances. And so in that sense, that's actually the goal with the technology that we're working on, that I think will be widely available in the next, you know, 10 years or something, as many people from different avenues are all working on it, and that is to bring people the experience of a true deep sense of peace and well-being, completely independent of what's happening around them, how good their memory is, how good their cognition is, how, you know, their resistance to disease, you know, all of these things that we're traditionally trying to augment. And that doesn't mean that we should sort of halt progress along those paths. I think I'd love to have better memory. You know, I'd love to be able to improve my emotional regulation or to improve my resistance to disease. But if I really get down to really the very heart of what I really seem to be driven by, it really is searching for the feeling of just being okay, of just right now, in this moment, being able to be absolutely, completely content with what is, not in a complacent sense where you just sort of stop doing stuff, but independent even of that, where you can be running around like a maniac trying to meet a deadline, or you could be at home relaxing on a couch. But in all of that, in all of those changing circumstances, fundamental to it is a sense that everything is okay.
Well, let me ask you, I have a question. In your opinion, in your personal opinion, do you think there's a danger, like if we look at in the Eastern studies of attaining these states, I mean, there's a lot of work involved, right? Like with the tools, like the sensei makes you work really hard to get there. And so I wonder, do you think, in your opinion, this getting a technology that would just take you right there, would that be a danger, like in terms, like you can get liposuction to take out your fat and you'll like look good, but you don't like have strength like you would if you work out? Do you feel, or have you seen like, or thought about philosophically, any discrepancy there? Do you think it's just a matter of getting the state happening and that there's not necessarily going to be a loss of something else by using a more advanced technology and just scrapping all the kind of hard work, so to speak?
Yeah, it's a great question, and of course it's something I've thought about a lot and had probably hundreds of hours of conversation about, and yeah, it's an important question for sure, and so thanks for bringing it up. There's a lot of, with all of this, there's so much cultural baggage that goes along with our preconceived ideas about what this is and how it's supposed to happen and what we're supposed to do. And we have a lot of cultural ideas also about the amount of suffering we're supposed to go through before we can, you know, finally be rewarded with our suffering. And anything we achieve should be the result of an incredible amount of suffering. We have a lot of those ideas as well. You really got to work for it. You got to work harder. Right. And then, you know... And so a lot of our ideas about enlightenment kind of come from this movie image of the guy in the cave meditating for, you know, however many tens of thousands of hours. And that totally happens, don't get me wrong. But you know, in Jeffrey's research, for example, and lots of people I've met, the stories can be very different. I mean, this is something that for some people can happen spontaneously, without any, you know, without any like serious training or practice. This is something that can happen in after reading one book, or something that can happen after a year, or after 6 months. There's no rules here. There seem to be a lot of preconceived ideas we have that can shape the experience. And so there's a deeper question, which is, okay, well, is there some bottleneck, you know, at which point it becomes dangerous, some physiological bottleneck or psychological bottleneck where you can just shift someone's experience too quickly or too dramatically can actually be harmful. I think that that's totally possible, and I think that's, you know, those concerns are true with essentially any imaginable intervention of any kind. There's going to be some limitations or issues. So this isn't I don't pretend this is somehow unique from, you know, from other interventions, psychological or medical or whatever. It has the same concerns and, you know, the same consideration in terms of how it works and what the dangers are and how you would structure it. And those, you know, as the sort of individual approaches, whether they be certain type of brain stimulation or a certain type of feedback, as those begin to emerge, they'll have the same kind of scrutiny and the same kind of research that goes along with them and the clinical studies and all of that stuff. So, you know, I'm not claiming some super magic thing here that's, you know, immune to the laws of reality or something.
Well, it's also interesting, I want to ask you this, is that the one part of your story that I have a little question about is that it sounds to me that in addition to, helping to create the zone culturally, doing meetups, doing conferences, getting a discourse going, meeting people, encouraging other people to explore in this kind of DIY maker space, and in addition to really being clear about your ultimate intention, which is to try to figure out how to encourage people to tap into that deep equanimity, that deep sort of compassionate detachment that allows people to not suffer even in the midst of difficult circumstances. That you also have partly through your through Jeffrey's work an idea of what, like a concrete conceptual idea of what enlightenment is, and that there are some people who have gotten there, and he's done studies and da-da-da. And those are all very interesting. I mean, I've looked at his research, and I can see that this is a remarkable phenomena that he's identified, and that there's clearly shared elements across different people, and there's different, you know, and this leads to different ideas of how you would get there. But the question I have is that in a way that seems to, how to say this, kind of shut down part of what's so interesting to me anyway about the space of consciousness hacking, about the DIY approach to consciousness and spirituality, which is that we don't know. We really don't know what enlightenment is, and we should be wary of developing too specific a model of what it is we're striving for. Instead, it almost seems like what you'd also want to be doing, and I know you're also doing that, this is kind of a rhetorical question, but that is precisely by developing a community of people who are exploring these things in different ways, using different modalities, but are somehow able to keep talking with one another so that something new can arise. Because who knows? It might be the case that every individual nervous system has its own way of becoming enlightened, and that there is just no one-stop shop for everybody, you know, and that it's much more open-ended, and that these states that Jeffrey's talking about are really powerful, but they're not necessarily the goal, if you know what I mean. There might be other goals or even contradictory goals. Anyway, I just want to throw that out there because it's just coming up in my head right now, and it's totally.
Yeah, let me address that. I mean, great, you know, great concern, and you know, these are things that, you know, make like such a short conversation tough because it's hard to like cover all your bases. So to try to address that, first I should say, first and foremost, the perspective I have is that I don't know. I don't know what this is. I don't know what reality is. I don't know what consciousness is. I live in a perpetual mystery. So don't be confused to think that I can sit down and say, this is enlightenment. Now, what I do think is important, like if you were studying anything, whether it's schizophrenia or depression or whatever, that you begin to build a model of it. And that model, if you're a good scientist, it's very clear that that model is not reality. That model is just a working representation that helps you to build interventions. And that's all. And you can look at any tradition and they have their own models. So this is essentially trying to build a model from a scientific perspective. That's all. And that model can allow for the type of flexibility that you're saying. It doesn't need to make us absolutely firm assumptions about, well, this is how it appears in the nervous system, or this is how it appears in the brain. It can have some, various models, even contradictory models, and that's fine. That can be explored and worked with and all of that. This is more of just any scientific finding that exists right now that I may look to as kind of pointing in the right direction, or even any technology that I may see as promising, is actually totally secondary to what I'm trying to get across. What I'm really trying to get across here is that it's possible from a scientific perspective to do what's been happening in Eastern traditions for thousands of years.
That's wonderful. And I just got to ask you a hard question. You made a really awesome answer, and it just reminds me of something. I was reading Charles Tart yesterday from 1971, and he was talking. He's the guy who came up with the concept of altered states of consciousness. Mm-hmm. So he's interested in exploring precisely the zone as a scientist. And one of the points he makes is he goes, there's a difference between these religious technologies of exploring altered states or developing these capacities and the scientific approach in precisely the terms you were talking about, that the scientists works with a model that's open-ended, that's always subject to revision, and that is articulated and explored in a community of other people who are devoted to the same values of open-mindedness, of criticism, of the provisional quality of all models, rather than the religious model where there's some kind of truth or some kind of teacher, there's some kind of ultimate authority. And so it's a really beautiful picture of how we might really go into these zones, but with a different twist, with an element from engineering, not just in terms of the technology, but in terms of the attitude.
I could not agree more. And that's science in its ideal form. Science is subject to, of course, the same kind of ossification of beliefs or hardened. Ideas, but there's a reason why the Dalai Lama is so adamantly in support of this scientific investigation, because that view can have so much openness, so much flexibility to it, and can actually work like really fluidly and build off really, really beautifully from the thousands of years of work that's been done already. And there doesn't actually need to be necessarily a conflict there.
Well, I think it's true, and there's really no reason to not, thinking about the things we do scientifically study, like, why would you not study the capacities of the human mind? Like, you're too busy studying Viagra or something, I don't know. Like, it's just like, why not do it?
I mean, when I take a step back and I kind of look big picture, I recognize I'm, I'm drinking my own flavor of Kool-Aid, like in my head, this is the most important thing that science can be exploring. The fundamental root of human suffering, arguably the very thing that everyone is seeking in their moment to moment existence at its very heart. And even taking a step sort of broader than that, just if you look at the direction that science has been pointing, it's been really focused on exploring things increasingly distant from ourselves, whether that be at the microscopic level, down to like particle accelerators or whatever, or at the macroscopic level looking at distant galaxies. But we're continually pointing out there. And there's actually a whole revolution of science that's possible where we actually begin exploring our inner world, where we actually turn 180 degrees and pursue a completely scientific-based exploration of human consciousness, which I really think is the next great scientific frontier.
That's great, man. So I think we're going to have to wrap it up here. I just wanted to throw one little conundrum into this picture and to point people to your website, which is MikeySiegel.com, M-I-K-E-Y-S-I-E-G-E-L.com, and your TEDx talks there. It's really great. The one trick is, though, for science to go into the mind and into the inner experience, the inner world, is that the brain... Science will have to reformulate the relationship of objectivity in a fundamental way. So it adds a whole tricky new zone that really is, I think, disturbing to a lot of people, but incredibly exciting to people like you.
Exactly.
All right, well, Mikey, thanks for joining us on Expanding Mind.
Thank you both. Really appreciate it. Had a great time.
Yeah, I look forward to your conferences and talks and stuff. So from Maj and me to all you out there, keep your minds open.